Wagging the Moon Doggy, Part 1, by Dave McGowan, as read from the Center for an Informed America's website, which is centerforaninformedamerica.com. Follow the tab for Wagging the Moon Doggy under Features, I believe, and you can read along as well. Thank you to Dave, who passed last year after a very brief but tragic battle with small cell lung cancer. Prolific researcher, voracious reader, our thoughts and prayers go out to his family. Wagging the Moon Doggy, Part 1, by Dave McGowan. It is commonly believed that man will fly directly from the Earth to the Moon, but to do this, we would require a vehicle of such gigantic proportions that it would prove an economic impossibility. It would have to develop sufficient speed to penetrate the atmosphere and overcome the Earth's gravity, and, having traveled all the way to the Moon, it must still have enough fuel to land safely and make the return trip to Earth. Furthermore, in order to give the expedition a margin of safety, we would not use one ship alone, but a minimum of three. Each rocket ship would be taller than the New York Empire State Building, almost a quarter mile high, and weigh about 10 times the tonnage of the Queen Mary, or some 800,000 tons. Wernher von Braun, father of the Apollo space program, writing in Conquest of the Moon. This is read straight from his website. You can go to centerforinformedamerica.com, jump down to the Moon Doggy tab, and click on Part 2 and follow along. So, jumping right back in, Wagging the Moon Doggy, Part 2, by David McGowan. Well, you now say, what about all those cool moon rocks? How did they get those? The moon is, you know, the only source of moon rocks. So doesn't that prove that we went there? No, as a matter of fact, it does not prove that we went there. As odd as that may sound, the moon is not the only source of moon rocks. As it turns out, authentic moon rocks are available right here on Earth, in the form of lunar meteorites. Because the moon lacks a protective atmosphere, you see, it gets smacked around quite a bit, which is why it's heavily cratered. When things smash into it to form those craters, lots of bits and pieces of the moon fly off into space. Some of them end up right here on Earth. By far the best place to find them is in Antarctica, where they are most plentiful and, due to the terrain, relatively easy to find and well-preserved. And that is why it is curious that Antarctica just happens to be where a team of Apollo scientists led by Wernher von Braun ventured off to in the summer of 1967, 2 years before Apollo 11 blasted off. You would think that, with the demanding task of perfecting the hugely complex Saturn V rockets, that von Braun and his cronies at NASA would have had their hands full, but apparently it was something even more important for them to do down in Antarctica. NASA has never offered much of an explanation for the curiously timed expedition. Some skeptics have said that it is possible that moon rocks could have been gathered from the moon with robotic probes. But while it isn't being argued here that unmanned craft haven't reached the moon, it seems virtually inconceivable that any unmanned spacecraft could have landed on and then been brought back from the surface of the moon in the 1960s or 1970s. There's no indication that it can even be done today. It's been more than three decades since anyone has claimed to do it, and that claim by the Soviets is highly suspect. What is known for sure is that even some of the, quote, debunking websites have, albeit reluctantly, acknowledged that meteorite samples gathered from Antarctica are virtually indistinguishable from NASA's collection of moon rocks. Of course, as we have very recently learned, that is not true of all of NASA's moon rocks. Some of them apparently bear no resemblance at all to lunar meteorites. Instead, they look an awful lot like petrified wood from the Arizona desert. Such was the case with a, quote, moon rock that the Dutch National Museum has been carefully safeguarding for many years now, before discovering, in August of 2009, that they were in reality the proud owners of the most over-insured piece of petrified wood on the planet. The, quote, moon rock had been a gift to the Dutch from the U.S. State Department, and its authenticity had reportedly been verified through a phone call to NASA. I'm guessing that NASA was probably running low on meteorite fragments and figured the Dutch wouldn't know the difference anyway. Or maybe Washington was a little peeved over the fact that the Dutch newspapers reportedly called NASA's bluff at the time of the first alleged moon landing. And you can see photos of these things, guys, over on the website. I'd recommend go checking that out. This is not to suggest, of course, that all of the moon rocks passed out by NASA and the State Department are obvious fakes. Most, presumably, are of lunar origin, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were gathered by American astronauts walking on the surface of the moon. They could have just as easily come to Earth as meteorites. It is also possible that they are of otherworldly origin, but not from the moon at all, such as meteorites from other sources that have been collected here on Earth. The only way to know for sure what NASA's moon rocks are, of course, would be to compare them to a, quote, control rock that is known to be from the moon. The problem, alas, is the only known source for authenticated moon rocks is NASA, the very same folks who are known occasionally to hand out chunks of petrified wood. The other problem, it turns out, is that most of the moon rocks are missing. Does anyone see a pattern developing here? Since the discovery of the fake moon rock in the Dutch Museum, quote, debunkers have claimed that the fact that no other moon rocks have been declared fake proves that the Dutch case is an isolated one. Quote, after that announcement, goes the argument, wouldn't every other country in possession of a moon rock have rushed to have them authenticated? And since no other country has made a similar announcement, doesn't that prove that the moon rocks are real? At first glance, that would appear to be a valid argument. The problem, however, is that the vast majority of those countries can't test their, quote, moon rocks because, shockingly enough, no one knows where they are. As the Associated Press reported on September 13, 2009, quote, nearly 270 rocks scooped up by U.S. astronauts were given to foreign countries by the Nixon administration. Of 135 rocks from the Apollo 17 mission given away to nations or their leaders, only about 25 have been located by CollectSpace.com, a website for space history buffs that has long attempted to compile a list. The outlook for tracking the estimated 134 of Apollo 11 rocks is even bleaker. The locations of fewer than a dozen are known. It appears then that having a control rock really wouldn't be much of a help at all, since nearly 90% of the alleged moon rocks that we would want to test don't seem to be around anymore. But I've also heard, you now say, that photos have been taken of the equipment left behind by the Apollo astronauts on the surface of the moon, like the descent stages of the lunar modules. How do you account for that? It's certainly true that there have been numerous claims over the years that various satellites or unmanned space probes or space telescopes were going to capture images that would definitely prove that man walked on the moon, thus settling the controversy once and for all. And in recent years, the debunkers have openly gloated whenever such an announcement has been made, boldly proclaiming that all the, quote, hoax believers will soon be exposed as the ignorant buffoons that they are. Despite all the promises, however, no such images have ever been produced. A fact that the debunkers seem to conveniently overlook while forever rushing to announce that the hoax theories are about to be discredited. For at least two decades now, since the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope, we have been promised dazzling images of the lunar modules sitting on the surface of the moon. The Hubble technology, needless to say, never managed to deliver. More recently, in 2002, the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, whose inventor apparently coined the name while watching Sesame Street, was also supposed to deliver the promised images. And 7 years later, the fabled images have yet to materialize. In March of 2005, Space.com boldly announced that, quote, a European spacecraft now orbiting the moon could turn out to be a time machine of sorts as it photographs old landing sites of Soviet robotic probes and the areas where American Apollo crews sat down and explored. New imagery of old Apollo touchdown spots from the Smart One probe might put to rest conspiratorial thoughts that U.S. astronauts didn't go the distance and scuff up the lunar landscape. NASA carried out 6 piloted landings on the moon in that time period, 1969 through 1972. Fringe theorists have said that NASA never really went to the moon. I'm guessing that most, quote, fringe theorists will continue to harbor, quote, conspiratorial thoughts for as long as pompous websites like space.com continue making arrogant proclamations such as that, and then not following them up with so much as a single image in well over 4 years. Who knew, by the way, that the European Space Agency had the technology and the budget to send a spacecraft to orbit the moon? Who knew that the Europeans even had a space agency? I wonder, given that they obviously have the technology to send spacecraft to the moon, why haven't they sent any manned missions there? I mean, I would think that it should be fairly easy to send some guys to at least orbit the moon, right? I mean, all they have to do is add a couple of seats to the spacecraft design that they already have. They should be ready to go. Here's another thing that I sometimes wonder about. Why is it that in the 1960s we possessed the advanced technology required to actually land men on the moon? But in the 21st century, we don't even have the technology required to get an unmanned aircraft close enough to the moon to take usable photographs? Or could it be that there's just nothing there to photograph? Just this year, NASA itself boldly announced that its Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, has returned its first imagery of the Apollo moon landing sites. The pictures show the Apollo mission's lunar module descent stages sitting on the moon's surface as long shadows from low sun angle make the module's locations evident. The LROC team anxiously awaited each image, said LROC Principal Investigator Mark Robinson of Arizona State University. We were very interested in getting our first peek at the lunar module descent stages just for the thrill and to see how well the cameras had come into focus. Indeed, the images are fantastic and so is the focus. Sounds promising, doesn't it? The images, however, hardly live up to the billing. They are, in fact, completely worthless. All they depict are tiny white dots of the lunar surface that could be just about anything that would be barely visible at all without those handy, quote, long shadows from the low sun angle. And the weird thing is about those shadows is that in the very same NASA article, it says that, quote, because the sun was so low to the horizon when the images were made, even subtle variations in topography create long shadows, unquote. And yet, while it's perfectly obvious that there are more than just, quote, subtle variations in the lunar topography in the images, and you can see the images on his website, the alleged lunar modules are the only things casting the long shadows. Even if we give NASA every benefit of the doubt and assume that the images have not been amateurishly photoshopped and that the indiscernible white dots are indeed something of man-made origin, the most likely culprit would be those Soviet robotic probes mentioned by Space.com, which presumably did land on the moon. A number of those probes, which were part of the Apollo-era lunar program, were very similar in size and shape to the lunar modules, certainly enough so that images of much higher resolution would be required to make a definitive judgment. Actually, after studying the image above, and you have to see this image, one of the alleged lunar probes, I'm going to have to say that the Soviets were lying their asses off almost as much as NASA was. There's no way I'm going to buy into the notion that the Soviets sent a free-form abstract sculpture, which appears to have been constructed by Fred Sanford and Granny Clampett, on a 234,000-mile journey from Earth to the Moon. Careful study of the central area of the photo, however, does reveal why the spacecraft were known as probes. According to NASA, Japan and India have also sent unmanned orbiting spacecraft to the Moon in recent years, as has China. As with the ESA and NASA's orbiters, they too have failed to return any images of earthly artifacts left behind on the surface of the moon. If the hoax debunking websites are to be believed, by the way, the reason that no one has returned to the moon in 37 years is because we pretty much already tapped that celestial body for all the information it had to offer. There's really, you see, nothing much left to see there. A, quote, debunking article posted by ABCnews.com, for example, quoted Val German, the president of the Central Missouri Astronomical Association, as saying, quote, there's no reason to go back. Quite frankly, the moon is a giant parking lot. There's just not much there. I wonder why it is then that just about everyone wants to send unmanned probes there, or to train enormously powerful telescopes on the moon's surface. What could they possibly learn about the, quote, parking lot from those distances that our astronauts didn't already discover by actually being there? Some true believers also claim that what was dubbed the Lunar Laser Ranging Experiment also proves that we really went to the moon. As the story goes, the astronauts on Apollo 11, Apollo 14, and Apollo 15 all allegedly left small laser targets sitting on the lunar terrain. One of them can be seen in the official NASA photograph reproduced below, so that scientists back home could then bounce lasers off the targets to precisely gauge the distance from the Earth to the moon. According to the debunkers, the fact that observatories to this day bounce lasers off the alleged targets proves that the Apollo mission succeeded. It is perfectly obvious, though, that the targets, if there, could have been placed robotically, most likely by the Soviets. It is also possible that there are no laser targets on the moon. In December 1966, National Geographic reported that scientists at MIT had been achieving essentially the same result for 4 years by bouncing a laser off the surface of the moon. The New York Times added that the Soviets had been doing the same thing since at least 1963. There was much about the Apollo flights that was truly miraculous, but arguably the greatest technological achievement was the design of the lunar modules. Has anyone, by the way, ever really taken a good look at one of those contraptions? I mean, a detailed up-close look? I'm guessing the vast majority of people have not, but luckily, we can quickly remedy that situation because I happen to have a really good, high-resolution image that comes directly from the good people at NASA. While what is depicted in the images may initially appear to the untrained eye to be some kind of mock-up that someone cobbled together in their backyard to make fun of NASA, I can assure you that it is actually an extremely high-tech manned spacecraft capable of landing on the surface of the moon. And incredibly enough, it was also capable of blasting off from the moon and flying 69 miles back up into the lunar orbit. Though not immediately apparent, is actually a two-stage craft. The lower half, the part that looks like a tubular aluminum framework covered with Mylar and old Christmas wrapping paper, being the descent stage, and the upper half, the part that looks as though it was cobbled together from old air conditioning ductwork, is primarily held together, as can be seen in a close-up, with zippers and gold tape, being the ascent stage. The other half, of course, is the more sophisticated portion, being capable of lifting off and flying with enough power to break free of the moon's gravity and reach lunar orbit. It also, of course, possessed sophisticated enough navigational capabilities for it to locate, literally out of the middle of frickin' nowhere, the command module that it had to dock with in order to get the astronauts safely back to Earth. It also had to catch that command module, which was orbiting the moon at a leisurely 4,000 miles per hour. But we'll get to all that a little later. I think we can all agree for now that such a sleek, stylish, well-designed craft would have no problem flying with that kind of power, precision, and stability. There is one thing that appears to be a problem, though. How did they get everything on board these modules that they were going to need to successfully complete their missions? According to NASA, the modules were, excluding the landing pads, were only about 12 feet in diameter. That is obviously not a whole lot of space to work with. So let's try to think of everything that we would need if we were astronauts venturing off on a little journey to the moon. First of all, of course, we would have to account for the space taken up by the various components of the ship itself. There is the framework and the, let's call it the fuselage of the craft. We will need a lot of various sophisticated navigation and guidance communications equipment, all of which took up a whole lot more space back in the 60s than it would today. And then, needless to say, there is the power supply, or rather multiple power supplies. For the descent stage, there is the reverse thrust rocket that allegedly allowed the craft to make soft landing on the moon. And then for the ascent stage, there is a more powerful rocket to propel the random bundle of sheet metal into lunar orbit. There are also additional rockets to allegedly stabilize the vessel in flight, the random clusters of what look like bicycle horns. Next up is the massive amount of fuel that would be required to power all of those rockets for both the ascent and descent stages of the mission. The ascent stage in particular is going to be a bit of a fuel hog, as ascending 69 miles and breaking free of the moon's gravity is a formidable challenge, to say the least. Though it might only have 1/6 the gravitational pull of the Earth, keep in mind that it's still a force strong enough to create the tides here on Earth, 234,000 miles away. I'm not a rocket scientist, by the way, so I'm sure that there are quite a few components that I'm leaving off my lunar module. But that's okay, because our spaceship is already feeling really cramped just with the stuff listed so far, and we're just getting started. Next, we'll have to include everything required to keep ourselves alive and well. We aren't going to be there very long, of course, and space is obviously limited, but we will still require some basic amenities. We will, after all, have to have somewhere to sleep in the ship, won't we? Or will we just unfold cots on the lunar surface? We'll also require a sanitation septic system of some kind, or did those missions bring about another first that NASA has been reluctant to brag about? Anyway, getting back to our packing list, in addition to a sanitation system, it is imperative that we bring along an adequate supply of food, water, and oxygen, and not just enough to last for the planned duration of our visit, but enough to supply a small safety cushion should anything go wrong. Because from what I've heard, running out of food, water, and oxygen while on the moon can really mess up an otherwise perfectly good trip. The oxygen is especially important, so we're going to need a really good, reliable system to deliver that oxygen and to, you know, recharge the oxygen tanks in our spacesuit so we can walk around on the moon and jump like 8 or 9 inches high like the Apollo guys did. And a backup oxygen system probably wouldn't be a bad idea. We're also going to need to install a top-of-the-line heating and cooling system, probably several of them, actually, because the, quote, weather on the moon, so to speak, can be a bit unpleasant. According to the experts over at NASA, daytime highs average a balmy 260 degrees Fahrenheit, but it cools off quite a bit at night, dropping to an average of minus 280 Fahrenheit. So if you're looking for anything between those two extremes, you really won't find it on the moon. It's pretty much one or the other. If you're in the sun, you're going to be boiled alive, and if you're out of the sun, you're going to be flash frozen. I'm not at all sure how the air conditioning system is going to work, come to think of it, since air conditioning requires a steady supply of, and please stop me if I'm stating the obvious here, air. And the moon really doesn't have a lot of that. It would help, of course, if our spacecraft was heavily insulated in some manner, but that doesn't appear to be the case. So we'll need a really good heating and cooling system, and plenty of Freon for whatever it is that we'll need to keep it running. And so now, add up all of the following to our already crowded spacecraft, ourselves, a minimal amount of room to sleep and otherwise take care of basic necessities of life, some type of plumbing and sewage system, really good heating and cooling system, a considerable food supply, water, oxygen, and we're still not done packing for our trip. Now we have to add all the equipment that will be required to maintain the ship and complete our planned missions. First of all, we're going to definitely need to pack an exhaustive supply of spare parts and wide variety of tools. That's an absolute must. There are lots of things that can go wrong with our spaceship, and the only thing harder than finding a good mechanic here on Earth is finding one on the moon. And then, of course, we'll have to bring all the fancy testing equipment that we'll use to pretend to conduct experiments. Some of it is quite bulky, so we'll need to set aside some storage space for all of that. And we're going to need some additional storage to bring back all those petrified wood samples. But we should have room for that after we jettison most of the fake testing equipment. Our spaceship is now so ridiculously overloaded that we may have had to add a roof rack, and we still aren't even quite done yet. We still have a couple more items to pack, and we probably should have gotten them on sooner because they're going to require a lot of space, since this is one of the later Apollo flights, you see. And we also have to pack a dune buggy, otherwise known as a lunar rover. And the picture's down here, guys. And the rovers, according to NASA, are a full 10 feet long, just 2 feet less than the diameter of our craft. But not to worry, according to NASA, the rovers, pictured below, folded up to the size of a large suitcase. When released, they would just sort of magically unfold and snap into place, ready to roam the lunar terrain. To be perfectly honest, I'm not really sure why we have to pack the damn rover. There is no real compelling reason to take it to the moon except for the fact that they make for good TV, and that seems to be of paramount importance. And so, as can be seen below, it should easily fit into our spaceship. One last thing we're going to need is a whole lot of batteries. Lots and lots of batteries. That's going to be the only way to power this ship while we're on the moon, and we'll definitely need to run the communication systems, and the oxygen supply system, and the heating and cooling systems, and the cabin lights, and the TV cameras, and transmitters, and all the testing equipment, and our spacesuits, and that damn rover. And we won't be able to recharge any of the various batteries, so we're going to need like a lot of backups. Especially the really big batteries that run the ship. We may need a separate ship just to carry all the batteries that we're going to need. By the way, I can't possibly be the only one who's disappointed that we never followed up on that breakthrough folding vehicle technology. If we had folding moon buggies back in the early 70s, then how far behind could folding automobiles have been had we chosen to stay the course? Had NASA's pioneering vision been followed up, we could all be folding up our cars and tucking them away under our office desks. But as with all the Apollo technology, it existed only in that specific period of time and has now sadly been lost to the ages. NASA has done something very odd, by the way, with the lunar module that it has on display for museum visitors to marvel at. It has staffed it with miniature astronauts wearing miniature spacesuits. The module may be scaled slightly larger than the real modules that allegedly landed on the moon. I wonder why they would do that. I'm pretty sure that Buzz and Neil were of normal stature. So the only reason that I could think that they would use miniature astronauts would be to portray the modules as larger than what they actually were, and in better condition, too. Did they pick up the ones they sent to the moon at a used car lot? Before moving on, I need to emphasize here just how sophisticated the lunar modules actually were. These remarkable spacecraft, and I understandably get a little choked up here talking about this because I'm just so damn proud of our team of Nazi scientists, managed to make 6 perfect takeoffs from the surface of the moon. And understand here, people, that they did that, amazingly enough, with completely untested technology. You can't duplicate the conditions on the moon here at home, you see, or even provide a rough approximation. And since no one had ever been to the moon, they didn't exactly know what to replicate anyway, so this part of the mission was pretty much of a crapshoot. Conditions on the moon are, to say the least, a bit different than here on Earth. The gravitational pull is only about 1/6 of what it is here. And then there is that whole lack of atmosphere thing, and the decidedly unearthly temperatures. And then, of course, there are high levels of space radiation. I'm quite sure that we had the best minds available working on the Apollo project, but none of them could have accurately predicted and compensated for how all those unearthly conditions would combine to affect the flight potential of the lunar modules. So the ability of the modules to actually blast off from the moon and fly was, at best, a theoretical concept. It is also important to remember that, unlike the initial blast-off from Earth, seen above, which involved the collective efforts of thousands of people and the use of all types of peripheral equipment, the astronauts taking off from the moon only had themselves and a strange vessel that looked like it had been salvaged from the set of Lost in Space. What would you be thinking, by the way, if you suddenly found yourself on the surface of the moon with what looked like a cheap movie prop as your only way home? Would you feel comfortable hanging around for a few days doing experiments, confident that when the time came, the untested contraption behind you would actually get you back home from the moon? Or would the words, bad career choice, be running through your head? But as it turns out, America kicked ass back then, and those lunar modules performed like champions every single time. They didn't even need modifications. Despite the completely foreign environment, they worked perfectly the first time, every time thereafter. On Earth, it took many long years of trial and error, many failed test flights, many unfortunate accidents, and many, many trips back to the drawing board before we could safely and reliably launch men into low Earth orbit. But on the moon? We nailed that the very first time. Today, of course, we can't even launch a space shuttle from right here on the planet without occasionally blowing one up, even though we have lowered our sights considerably. After all, sending spacecraft into low Earth orbit is considerably easier than sending spacecraft all the way to the friggin' moon and back. It would appear then that we can draw the following conclusion. Although technology has advanced immeasurably since the first Apollo moon landing, and we have significantly downgraded our goals in space, we can't come close to matching the kick-ass safety record we had in the Apollo days. The thing is that back in the frontier days, we didn't need all that fancy technology and book learning to send Buzz and the boys to the moon and back. But then, back then we had that American can-do spirit. We just cowboyed up and MacGyvered those spaceships to the moon. All we needed was an old Volkswagen engine, some duct tape, and a roll of baling wire. Throw a little toilet paper and Tang on board and you're good to go. How about the speed with which we cranked out those Apollo spacecraft? Once we figured out how to make them, we were stamping them out like Coke cans. We fired off 7 of them in just under 3.5 years, or about 1 every 6 months. Given the extreme complexity of those vessels and the fact that every component had to perform flawlessly under largely unknown conditions, that's a pretty impressive production schedule. America, I think it's safe to say, totally rocked back then. And that's the end of part 2 of Wagging the Moondoggy by David McGowan. Follow the links over in the blog post or head over to centerforinformedamerica.com and head down to the Moondoggy tab and check it out. Go support Dave and his family with a purchase of a book or a donation. And thank you for joining me. Catch you next time. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we're going to pick up in Wagging the Moondoggy with Part 3 by David McGowan. Head over to centerforinformedamerica.com and scroll down to the Features tab. And once again, we're on Part 3. Feel free to pick up and join us. Let's jump right in. If the moon landings were fake, then one question that naturally arises is, why would the government go to such extreme lengths to mount such an elaborate hoax? The most obvious answer, and the one most frequently cited by skeptics, is to reclaim a sense of national pride that had been stripped away by America's having played follow the leader with the Soviets for an entire decade. While this undoubtedly played a large role, there are other factors as well, factors that haven't been as fully explored. But before we look at those, we must first deal with the question of whether it would have even been possible to pull off such an enormous hoax. Could so many people have really been duped into believing such an outrageous lie, if that in fact was what it was? To answer that question, we have to keep in mind that we're talking about the summer of 1969 here. Those old enough to have been there will recall that they, along with the vast majority of politically active people in the country, spent that particular period of time primarily engaged in tripping on some really good acid, most likely from the lab of Mr. Owsley. In truth, not everyone was fooled by the alleged moon landings. Though it is rarely discussed these days, a significant number of people gave NASA's television productions a thumbs down. As Wired magazine has reported, quote, when night newspapers pulled 1,721 U.S. residents 1 year after the first moon landing, it found that more than 30% of the respondents were suspicious of NASA's trips to the moon. Given that overall trust in government was considerably higher in those pre-Watergate days, the fact that nearly a third of Americans doubted what they were, quote, witnessing through their television sets is rather remarkable. When Fox ran a special on the moon landing some years back and reported that 1 in 5 Americans had doubts about the Apollo missions, various, quote, debunking websites cried foul and claimed that the actual percentage was much lower. BadAstronomy.com, for example, claims that the actual figure is about 6%, and that roughly that many people will agree, quote, with almost any question that is asked of them. Hence, there are only a relative handful of kooks who don't believe that we've ever been to the moon. All of those websites fail to mention, of course, that among the people who experienced the events as they were occurring, nearly 1 in 3 had doubts, a number considerably higher than the number that Fox used. And needless to say, the debunkers also failed to mention that 1 in 4 young Americans, a number also higher than the figure Fox used, have doubts about the moon landings. Returning then to the question of why such a ruse would be perpetrated, we must transport ourselves back to the year 1969. Richard Nixon has just been inaugurated as our brand new president, and his ascension to the throne is in part due to his promises to the American people that he will disengage from the increasingly unpopular war in Vietnam. But Tricky Dick has a bit of a problem on his hands in that he has absolutely no intention of ending that war. In fact, he would really like to escalate the conflict as much as possible, but to do so, he needs to set up a diversion, some means of stoking the patriotic fervor of the American people so that they will blindly rally behind him. In short, he needs to wag the dog. This has, of course, traditionally been done by embarking on some short-term, low-risk military endeavor. The problem for Dick, however, is that a military mission is exactly what he is trying to divert attention away from. What, then, is a beleaguered president to do? Why, send Neil and Buzz to the moon, of course. Instead of wagging the dog, it's time to try something new, wagging the moon doggy. Nixon's actions from the very moment he takes office belie his campaign pledges to the American people. In May of 1969, with Nixon just a few months into his term, the press begins publicizing the illegal B-52 carpet bombing of Cambodia, engineered by irrepressible war criminal Henry Kissinger. By June, Nixon is scrambling to announce what is dubbed the, quote, Vietnamization of the war, which comes with a concomitant withdrawal of U.S. troops. In truth, however, only 25,000 of the 540,000 U.S. troops then deployed will be brought home. This ruse is therefore transparently thin, and it will buy the president little time. To make matters worse, on July 14th, Francis Reitmeier is granted conscientious objector status on the basis of a petition his attorney has filed, which explicitly details the training and instruction he has just received in assassination and torture techniques in conjunction with his assignment in the CIA's Phoenix program. With these documents entering the public domain, the full horrors of the war are beginning to emerge. Just in time to save the day, however, Apollo 11 blasts off on July 16th on its allegedly historic mission, and, with the entire nation enthralled, 4 days later the Eagle purportedly makes its landing on the pristine lunar surface. Vietnam is temporarily forgotten as America swells with patriotic pride for having beaten the evil empire to the moon. There is little time to worry about the brutality of war when Neil is taking that, quote, one giant leap for mankind. The honeymoon is short-lived, however, for just 4 months later, in November of 1969, Seymour Hersh publishes a story about the massacre of 504 civilians in the village of My Lai, bringing home to America the full savagery of the war in Southeast Asia. It's time then for another moon launch, and Apollo 12 dutifully lifts off on November 14th, making another picture-perfect lunar landing before returning on November 24th. The country is once again entranced by the exploits of America's new breed of hero, and suddenly every kid in the country wants to grow up to be an astronaut. All is well again until March of 1970, at which time a U.S.-backed coup deposes Prince Sihanouk in Cambodia and Lon Nol is handpicked by the CIA to replace him. Cambodia then immediately jumps in the fray by committing troops to the U.S. war effort. The war is further escalated the next month when Nixon authorizes an invasion of Cambodia by U.S. and ARVN ground forces, another move engineered by Henry Kissinger. Nixon has been in office just over a year, and the war, far from winding down, has now expanded into Cambodia, both in the air and on the ground. Meanwhile, it's time for yet another moon launch. But this one is not going to be just any moon launch. This one, you see, is going to introduce the element of danger. With the first two having gone off without a hitch, the American people, known for having notoriously short attention spans, are already adopting a been-there-done-that attitude. The problem in a nutshell is that it just looks a little too damn easy. In order to regain the attention of the American people, it has to be impressed upon them that our brave astronauts are placing themselves in grave danger. And so it is that on April 11, 1970, Apollo 13 blasts off with Tom Hanks and a couple of somewhat lesser-known actors on board. But unlike the first two missions, this Apollo spacecraft fails to reach the moon, and instead drifts about for the next 6 days with the crew in mortal danger of being forever lost in space. Now that gets our attention. So much so that when three Vietnam vets hold a multi-city press conference in New York, San Francisco, and Rome on April 14th, attempting to publicize the ongoing Phoenix program, in which they have participated and have first-hand knowledge, nobody can really be bothered with paying much attention. It's hard to be too concerned with the fate of Vietnamese villagers, you see, when Tom and the boys are clearly in trouble. Awaiting news of the fate of the Apollo 13 crew, we all have our eyes glued to the TVs as though we're watching post-mortem coverage of Michael Jackson. When our heroes somehow make it back alive, defying seemingly impossible odds, we're all so damn proud of them that we decide to award Tom another Oscar, and all is well again for the remainder of the year. I really have to repeat here, by the way, that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, America really did rock. I mean, how about the Apollo safety record? 7 manned moon launches with 7 perfect takeoffs. Tom and the boys obviously never did make it to the moon, but the other 6 crews sure as hell did. And all 6 set those lunar modules down like the consummate professionals that they were. And all 6 used that untested technology to successfully blast off from the moon and attain lunar orbit. And then all 6 successfully docked with the orbiting command modules. And all 7 of those command modules, even Apollo 13s, returned intact with their crews, happy and healthy. That was just an awesome time to be an American, and especially to be an American astronaut. Well, except for 3 guys. Virgil Gus Grissom, Ed White, and Roger Chaffee, who were burned alive during a test procedure in the command module of what was to be Apollo 1. But they were troublemakers anyway, who probably wouldn't have wanted to go along with the moon landing fable. And then there was that Thomas Barron guy, who was a safety inspector for NASA and who delivered highly critical testimony and a 1,500-page report to Congress, only to then be killed a week later. That report seems to have been sucked into the same black hole that swallowed up all the other Apollo evidence. Anyway, returning now to our timeline, the dawn of 1971 brings the trial of Lieutenant William Calley on charges that he personally ordered and oversaw the mass murder of the inhabitants of the village of My Lai. And on January 31st, Apollo 14 is launched and once again makes a flawless lunar landing. On February 9th, the Apollo team returns just a few weeks before Calley is convicted of murder. He served an absurdly short sentence under house arrest, and none of his superiors were ever held accountable. A few months after that, the New York Times begins publication of the infamous Pentagon Papers, revealing American policy in Vietnam to be a complex web of lies. Publication is quickly stopped by the Justice Department, but resumes once again as June turns to July. This is quickly followed on July 26 by the launch of Apollo 15. 4 days later, yet another flawless lunar landing clearly demonstrates that America is the most badass nation on Earth. But moonwalking has become a bit of a bore for the American people, so a new element is introduced. And from now on, our beloved astronauts will roam the lunar surface in dune buggies. The lunar modules haven't gotten any bigger, but now they can transport vehicles to the moon. Cool. Back on Earth, the astronauts return on August 7th, and the rest of the year passes uneventfully. On March 30, 1972, North Vietnamese troops mount a massive offensive across the DMZ into Kang Tri Province, revealing, as lies the pompous statements by numerous Washington hacks, that victory is close at hand. Nixon and company respond to the offensive with deep penetration bombing of North Vietnam and, for good measure, the illegal mining of North Vietnam's ports. They also respond by launching, on April 16th, another rocket and another dune buggy to the moon. On April 27th, the crew of Apollo 16 once again return to a hero's welcome. By the end of the year, a ceasefire is finally looming on the horizon. Beginning in October, Kissinger and David Bruce, a member of the infamous Mellon family, are secretly negotiating peace terms with Le Duc Tho of North Vietnam. In December, however, those talks break down, but not before Apollo 17 is launched on December 7th in a most spectacular way. It's the first night launch of a Saturn V rocket. With the latest Apollo mission still a few days away from returning, the talks cease, and Dick and Henry unleash a final ruthless carpet bombing campaign against North Vietnam, snuffing out countless thousands of civilian lives. Meanwhile, America warmly greets its returning astronauts. Just 5 weeks later, the talks having resumed, a peace agreement is announced. Within a few days, a ceasefire is in effect, thereby officially ending America's involvement in Southeast Asia. Though the CIA will remain to continue directing the war by proxy, America's men and women in uniform come home. And the Apollo program, despite several additional missions having been planned and discussed, and despite the additional funding that should have been available with the war drawing to a close, will never be heard from again. In addition to restoring national pride and providing a diversion from the savage colonial war being waged in Southeast Asia, the Apollo program undoubtedly served another function as well, covert funding of that war effort. Needless to say, faking moon landings is less expensive than actually making moon landings, and a whole lot of money was funneled NASA's way during the Vietnam years to accomplish the latter. It stands to reason that a considerable amount of that money could well have been diverted into covert operations being conducted in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. In addition, a portion of the Apollo funding likely financed the early stages of the militarization of space. There's no shortage of moon hoax debunking sites out there on the wild and woolly World Wide Web. The majority of them are not particularly well written or argued, and yet they tend to be rather smug and self-congratulatory. Most of them tend to stick to debunking the same facts, and they use the same arguments to do so. One thing they like to talk a lot about is the Van Allen radiation belts. The moon hoax sites talk a lot about them as well. The hoaxers will tell you that man cannot pass through the belts without a considerable amount of radiation protection, protection that could not have been provided in the 1960s through any known technology. And the debunkers claim that the Apollo astronauts would have passed right through the belts quickly enough that, given the levels of radiation, no harm would have come to them. The hoaxers say debunkers are just being girly men. As it turns out, both sides are wrong. The debunkers, shockingly enough, are completely full of shit, and the hoaxers have actually understated the problem by focusing exclusively on the belts. We know this because NASA itself, whom the debunkers like to treat as virtually unimpeachable source on all things Apollo, except, apparently, when the agency posts an article that implicitly acknowledges that we haven't actually been to the moon, has told us that it is so. They have told us that in order to leave low Earth orbit on any future space flights, our astronauts would need to be protected throughout the entirety of the flight, as well as, and once again this comes directly from NASA, while working on the surface of the moon. On June 24, 2005, NASA made this rather remarkable admission, quote, NASA's vision for space exploration calls for a return to the moon as preparation for even longer journeys to Mars and beyond. But there's a potential showstopper, radiation. Space beyond low Earth orbit is awash with intense radiation from the sun and deep galactic sources such as supernovas. Back in the 1960s, of course, we didn't let a little thing like space radiation get in the way of us beating the Ruskies to the moon. But now, I guess, being that we're more cultured and sophisticated, we want to do it the right way, so we need to come up with a way of shielding our spaceships and our temporary moon bases. And figuring out how to do that, according to NASA, could be a real, quote, showstopper. As NASA notes, the most common way to deal with radiation is simply to physically block it, as the thick concrete around a nuclear reactor does. But making spaceships from concrete is not an option. Lead, which is considerably denser than concrete, is actually the preferred material to use for radiation shielding. But lead also isn't very popular with spaceship designers. In fact, word on the street is that one of the main reasons the Soviets never made it to the moon was because their scientists calculated that 4 feet of lead shielding would be required to protect their astronauts. And those same scientists apparently felt that spaceships wouldn't fly all that well when clad with 4 feet of lead. Now NASA is thinking outside the box and contemplating using force fields to repel the radiation, a seemingly ridiculous idea that, whether workable in the future or not, certainly wasn't available to NASA in the 1960s. Below is NASA's own artist's rendering of a proposed force field radiation shield that would allow astronauts to work safely on the moon. As you may have noticed, in the earlier photos of lunar modules, our guys didn't bring anything like that with them on their earlier missions to the moon. And you might have also noticed that the modules didn't have any type of physical shielding. He's got the pictures up here, guys. You have to check it out on the website. How then did they do it? My guess is that the answer lies in that gold foil wrap. While it may look like an amateurish attempt to make the modules appear more high-tech, I have a hunch that what we're looking at is another example of that lost 1960s technology, this time in the form of a highly advanced superpolymer that provided maximum radiation shielding while adding virtually no weight. So all we have to do is track down a few leftover rolls of that stuff, and we should be well on our way to sending guys back to the moon. According to Charles Buehler, a NASA scientist currently working on the force field concept, quote, using electric fields to repel radiation was one of the first ideas back in the 1950s when scientists started to look at the problem of protecting astronauts from radiation. They quickly dropped the idea, though, because it seemed like the high voltages needed and the awkward designs that they thought would be necessary would make such an electric shield impractical. What a real journalist would have asked here, of course, is, quote, after dropping the electric shield concept, what exactly did they decide to use to get our astronauts safely to the moon and back on the Apollo missions? And why can't we do the same thing now, rather than reinventing the wheel? Don't you guys have some of that gold foil in a closet somewhere? No one in the American media, of course, bothered to ask such painfully obvious questions. The 2005 report from NASA ends as follows, quote, but who knows, perhaps one day astronauts on the moon will work safely. Unquote. Yes, and while we're dreaming the impossible dream, let's add a few more things to our wish list as well. Like perhaps one day we'll be able to listen to music on 8-track tape players, and talk to people on rotary dial phones, and carry portable transistor radios, and use cameras that shoot pictures on special film that develops right before our eyes. Only time will tell, I suppose. The Van Allen belts, by the way, trap most earthbound radiation, thus making it safe for us mortals down here on the surface of planet Earth, as well as for astronauts in low Earth orbit. The belts extend from 1,000 to 25,000 miles above the surface of the Earth. The danger is in sending men through and beyond the belts, which, apart from the Apollo missions, has never been attempted. Well, actually, there was that one time, but I think we all remember how badly that turned out. In case anyone has forgotten, the astronauts return to a world dominated by extremely poor acting, apes speaking with British accents, and a shirtless Charlton Heston. And I don't think anyone wants to see that happen again. The 2005 report was not the first time that NASA had openly discussed the high levels of radiation that existed beyond the Van Allen belts. In February 2001, the space agency posted a debunking article that argued that the rocks allegedly brought back from the moon were so distinctive in nature that they proved definitively that man had gone to the moon. The problem, though, with maintaining a lie of the magnitude of the moon landing lie is that there is always the danger in that defending one part of the lie, another part will be exposed. Such was the case with NASA's ill-conceived The Great Moon Hoax post, in which it was acknowledged that what are referred to as cosmic rays have a tendency to, quote, constantly bombard the moon, and they leave their fingerprints on moon rocks. NASA scientist David McKay explained that, quote, there are isotopes in moon rocks, isotopes we don't normally find on Earth, that were created by nuclear reactions with the highest energy cosmic rays. The article went on to explain how, quote, Earth is spared from such radiation by our protective atmosphere and magnetosphere. Even if scientists wanted to make something like a moon rock by, say, bombarding an Earth rock with high-energy atomic nuclei, they couldn't. Earth's most powerful particle accelerators can't energize particles to match the most potent cosmic rays, which are themselves accelerated in supernova blast waves and in the violent cores of galaxies. So one of the reasons that we know that the moon rocks are real, you see, is because they were blasted with ridiculously high levels of radiation while sitting on the surface of the moon. And our astronauts, one would assume, would have been blasted with the very same ridiculously high levels of radiation. But since this was NASA's attempt at a debunking article, they apparently would prefer that you don't spend too much time analyzing what they have to say. How exactly are we to reconcile NASA's current position on space radiation with the same agency's simultaneous claim that we've already sent men to the moon? There are a few different possibilities that come to mind, the first of which is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, we simply threw caution into the wind and sent our boys off to the moon with no protection whatsoever from space radiation. If that were true, however, then the question that would naturally be raised is, why not just do it again? After all of our moonwalkers made it home safe and sound, and most have lived long, healthy, cancer-free lives. So why all the fuss over space radiation? NASA could, I suppose, take the position that space radiation is a recent problem. Perhaps in the 60s and 70s, space was relatively free of radiation, allowing unshielded Apollo rockets to cruise about without a care in the world. It was just a different solar system back in those days. As aging hippies like to say, if you remember the solar system of the 60s, you weren't really flying around in it. If it proves to be the case that this space radiation, quote, showstopper is a new development, then I suppose that the only explanation that we are left with is that we did indeed have the technology to shield our astronauts from radiation back in the 60s, but at some time during the last 4 decades, that technology was simply lost. What probably happened was an overzealous night custodian threw the data away. The conversation around the NASA water cooler the next day probably went something like this. Has anyone seen the folder I left on my desk last night? It contained the only copy of the secret formula that I devised for building a weightless space radiation shield. It could be 40 years or more before someone else can duplicate it. My ass is so fired. And that's the end of Wagging the Moondoggy, Part 3. Once again, head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com and follow the feature tab down to Moondoggy, and feel free to follow along as we continue in this interesting and entertaining read. Thanks again for joining me. Look forward to catching you next time. Take care.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying this reading of Wagging the Moondoggy by Dave McGowan. Today we're going to pick up in part 4, which is a part that I really like because it's very heavily centered on photography, and it's a topic that I have a background and interest in. Dave has a strong background in photography, which is evident in his breakdown and analysis of this particular issue, which he really moves through quickly, and he provides tons of examples straight from the source. So let's jump right in. Wagging the Moondoggy, part 4, by David McGowan. Once on the moon, on the lunar surface, in the dress, in the life support system, you couldn't see the camera. They couldn't bend their head that far down to see the scale. They had no viewfinder. They had to aim by moving their body. Jan Lundberg, chief designer of the Hasselblad cameras allegedly used by the Apollo astronauts. They had to effectively guess where they were pointing the camera. H.J.P. Arnold, the Kodak executive who supplied the ektachrome film for the missions. The issue that most of the moon hoax and debunking sites spend the most time on, by far, is the photographic anomalies. And that, I suppose, is to be expected, with the original videotapes, telemetry tapes, and blueprints all having conveniently disappeared, and with most of the moon rocks missing and their legitimacy being unverifiable, there isn't much else in the way of physical evidence to examine. Skeptics have identified a number of problems with NASA's official photographs of the alleged moon landings, including flags appearing to wave despite the lack of atmosphere, non-parallel shadows suggesting multiple light sources, objects in the shadows that are clearly visible when they shouldn't be, again indicating multiple light sources, the complete lack of stars in the lunar sky, identical backgrounds in photos that NASA claimed were shot at different locations, and inconsistency with the crosshair reference marks. We'll look at each of these in some detail. Well, we'll actually look at most of them in some detail because, as it turns out, and I know that this will come as a huge disappointment to all the debunkers, but I don't really give a shit whether the flag is waving or not. Many of the debunking websites devote an inordinate amount of time to the issue, as though it were the primary plank on which the, quote, conspiracy theories rested. They do this because the videos and photos are ambiguous and open to interpretation, and the debunkers realize that people are going to see in them what they want to see. The truth, though, is that it doesn't matter in the least whether the flag is waving. That is just one tiny drop of potential evidence in an overflowing bucket. Some of the other problems with the images are considerably less ambiguous. But before we even get to those, we must first discuss the fact that the very existence of the photographs is a technical impossibility. Simply stated, it would not have been possible to capture any of the images allegedly shot on the moon in the manner that NASA says they were captured. Back in the day, you see, and younger readers may again want to cover their eyes, cameras weren't all that smart. So everything had to be done manually. The photographer had to manually focus each shot by peering through the viewfinder and rotating the lens until the scene came into focus. The proper aperture and shutter speeds had to be manually selected for each shot as well to ensure a proper exposure. That required peering through the viewfinder as well to meter the shot. Finally, each shot had to be properly composed and framed, which, obviously, also required looking through the viewfinder. The problem for the astronauts is that the cameras were mounted to their chests, which made it impossible to see through the viewfinder to meter, frame, and focus the shots. Everything, therefore, was pretty much of a guess. Focusing would have been entirely guesswork, as would the framing of each shot. An experienced photographer can accurately estimate the exposure settings, but the astronauts lacked such experience, and they were also handicapped by the fact that they were viewing the scenes through heavily tinted visors, which meant that what they were seeing was not what the camera was seeing. To add to their troubles, they were wearing space helmets that seriously restricted their field of vision, along with enormously bulky, pressurized gloves that severely limited their manual dexterity. The odds of them getting even one of the three elements, exposure, focus, and framing, correct under those conditions on any given shot would have been exceedingly low. And yet, amazingly enough, on the overwhelming majority of the photos, they got all three right. A rather self-important gent by the name of Jay Winley, one of the most prominent of the NASA-approved debunkers, attempts to spin all this away on his website, clavius.org. According to Winley, quote, "The exposures were worked out ahead of time based on experimentation. The ASA-ISO rating of the film was known, and NASA photographers pre-computed the necessary exposures. In many cases, the camera settings for planned photos were given in the astronauts' cuff checklists. Did they send an advance team to the moon to do that experimentation? Because the lighting conditions on the moon are pretty unique, as you well know, and nobody had ever been there before. So I'm not really seeing how NASA's photographers were able to work out the exposures, quote, ahead of time. And what, quote, planned photos are you referring to? How did they know what they were going to photograph before they even knew what was there? They knew they were going to take photos of each other, I suppose, and of the flag and the lander. But they would have had no clue how those things were going to be lit. And it's the lighting, not the subject, that primarily determines the exposure settings. Winley, of course, knows that, since he claims on his site that he is, quote, an experienced photographer who has worked professionally in that area from time to time. He must also know, then, that his comments about the unimportance of properly focusing a shot are intentionally misleading. He starts off on the right track, more or less, advising readers that an increased depth of field, quote, means that when the lens is set to focus at a certain distance, objects somewhat nearer and farther from this ideal distance are also sharply focused. The narrower the aperture, the greater the depth of field. It is certainly true that the smaller the aperture, the greater the depth of field will be, and the greater the depth of field, the more of the background and foreground will be in focus, assuming that the subject is in proper focus. Winley, like the rest of the debunkers, would like us to believe that all of the photos shot on the lunar surface were shot with a very small aperture setting, which supposedly explains the lack of stars in the lunar sky, but we'll get to that soon enough, which would maximize the depth of field. And the greater the depth of field, according to Winley, the sloppier the photographer can be about his focus settings, unquote. I might jump in really quick and add a couple of notes, just for those that really are unfamiliar with photography. The word aperture, think of the iris in your pupil of your eye. When you are outside on a bright sunny day, the pupil dilates to a very small opening to effectually stop light from coming in. Only so much light is required to light a scene. The pupil of the eye adjusts to the proper setting every time. And as we all know, you step out of a brightly lit day into a dark room, the pupil of the eye dilates now to a large aperture. In photography, the larger the number, the smaller the aperture. It'd be a bright, sunny day. The smaller the number, the larger the aperture. It's just the opposite of what one would intuitively think. So, in effect, the larger the number, the more light you're stopping from entering the scene. Landscape and architectural photographers tend to work in a wide-angle environment with a wide depth of field. If an individual is in doubt, they can set the aperture to f8. It's called the f8 rule for street photography. You're just walking around and you want to shoot. And if your focus ring is somewhere in the middle or maybe even set to infinity, you'll most likely get a clean shot of something. Portrait photographers will work in a shallow depth of field to isolate their subject, to throw the background or the foreground out of focus. You know, the eyes are usually the focal point of a portrait. And so that's usually where you locate a tack sharp focus and let everything else fall out as need be. Some of the images that Dave shows here that are provided by NASA are captured with a shallow depth of field. The more open the lens is, the faster it is that one can shoot. And when that occurs, when one is shooting at a fast aperture, not even a very long shutter speed is required to really bring in a lot of stars in the sky. If the image is stopped down to, like, say, f16, which is a very small opening, it's going to require a much longer shutter speed. You're going to require a tripod. Every time, if you're going to shoot in a broad depth of field, a tripod is almost always required. In today's cameras, the ISO, which was the former ASA, the film speed, is now the sensor sensitivity. Being able to see real time in today's mirrorless cameras, the camera that I use will actually show me what's in focus. They didn't have that luxury back in the day, and they were shooting with rangefinder cameras. To Mr. Winley and to the NASA photography team's credit, rangefinder cameras can be calculated based on distance. They don't function as a 35mm SLR usually. A rangefinder camera has a lens assembly that is acquiring the image, and the viewer is not looking through an image that's bounced, which is what a single lens reflex is, an SLR. It's bouncing the image that you're seeing from the lens. It's bouncing it through two mirror assemblies up into your eye through the viewfinder, whereas a rangefinder camera doesn't do that. It's off to the side, and it's just there for a distance calculation. So if they have their distances calculated, they can guess and point and shoot. Whether they're looking through or not, doesn't matter. All they're going to be seeing is something that is a tool there to help them calculate the distance. And usually rangefinder photography requires the use of peripheral tools to help you really dial in an accurate shot. So photographically speaking, it's not an altogether beyond the pale impossibility, but the likelihood of such imagery coming back in such fashion is just as fantastic as anything else when looked at in detail. Continuing. So the greater the depth of field, according to Winley, the sloppier the photographer can be about his focus settings. That last statement, for those who may have missed it, is the part that actually isn't true. An increased depth of field most certainly does not mean that you can use the close enough technique to focus your camera. depth of field has nothing to do with whether your subject is sharply focused or not. If your subject is sharply focused, then depth of field determines how many of the other objects in your background or foreground of your photo will be in focus as well. If your subject is not sharply focused, however, then your photo is going to suck regardless of the amount of depth of field. And that is true. As for framing the shots, Windley claims that mostly wide-angle lenses were used, which meant that, quote, it was sufficient enough to point the camera in the general direction of the subject, and you would be likely to frame it well enough, unquote. So apparently all of the fuss about framing, exposure, and focus is much ado about nothing. All you need to do is write down the exposure settings on your sleeve, ballpark the focus, and point your camera, quote, in the general direction of your subject, and you'll get great shots nearly every time. Windley then adds, and this is my favorite part of his photography tutorial, that on the later missions, quote, a 500mm telephoto lens was also taken, and the cameras were modified with sighting rings to help aim them. Normally the camera would be mounted on the spacesuit chest bracket, but for telephoto use, the astronaut would have to remove it and hold it at eye level in order to sight down the rings. As any photographer knows, getting a decent shot with a 500mm lens without the use of a tripod is a pretty tall order, even for a seasoned professional. Getting a decent handheld shot with a 500mm lens while wearing bulky, pressurized gloves would be just about impossible. And the notion that you could come anywhere close to properly framing or focusing an image captured with a 500mm lens without looking through the viewfinder is laughably absurd. And that is true. Shooting with a long lens like that is very difficult. 500mm is inherently a very shallow depth of field regardless. You can open it up, but you are going to be using a tripod or that image is going to be utterly useless and blurry. And not only a tripod, but a gimbal head. A gimbal head is a precision ball-bearing head that usually is what is attached to the tripod. The actual lens is so huge, the lens is attached to the tripod, not the camera body. So shooting handheld with a 500mm lens is a very, very challenging task without a tripod. I can't emphasize that enough. And the point that Dave aptly makes here very soon is that we should see, especially with the absence of an atmosphere on the moon, supposedly, allegedly, we should be having a very vibrant star shots from the surface of the moon. And these don't exist. And look at the photos and just determine for yourself. Normally, if no stars are present in a night photograph, it's because the image is likely underexposed and stopped down too far. The aperture isn't open enough. Not enough light is coming in. The conditions are not sensitive enough, and the settings are not proper in the exposure triangle, that is, aperture, shutter speed, and ISO, despite framing issues. Again, they can't look down, so they're just going to be pointing and shooting, allegedly. But again, in their defense, it could have happened that way, but the likelihood of it is just, it is really hard to believe, photographically, especially with the quality of these images. If it's legit, they had to really practice this photographically. It just doesn't happen like that. I mean, this is what separates paid photographers from those who are just enthusiasts, is really dialing in the exposure triangle and how important it is to acquire tack sharp focus, to really flatter your subject, to really separate it from its background, to do everything that's possible in the camera without the use of any post-production to separate their subject and flatter their subject as much as possible. Then when they bring it into post, they can really go farther and go the extra mile to further flatter their subject. This happened in the analog world. Now it happens in the digital world. Today, Photoshop is just a digital darkroom. It was developed after Ansel Adams' processing technique. These are things that a lot of people aren't aware of. It's not there for photo surrealism and to add things that don't exist. It's there to actually make the photograph. As Ansel Adams famously quoted, you don't take a photograph, you make it. And he understood that. And that's why his photos stand the test of time. He made them such. You can't just take that photograph. You have to make it. The debunkers will also tell you that it is not true that all the moon landing images were keepers, and that NASA only released the best of the photos. The debunkers, however, do not know what they're talking about. The reality is that NASA has released all of the alleged photos taken during the Apollo missions, including indecipherable ones that are labeled, quote, inadvertent shutter release, which I have to admit is a nice touch. With the exception of what are most likely deliberate mistakes, the clear majority of the shots are pretty well composed, exposed, and focused. For those who don't find that at all unusual, here's an experiment that you can try at home. Grab the nearest 35mm SLR camera and strap it around your neck. It's probably an automatic camera, so you'll have to set it for manual focus and manual exposure. Now you'll need to put on the thickest pair of winter gloves you can find, as well as a motorcycle helmet with a visor. Once you've done all that, here's your assignment. Walk around your neighborhood with the camera pressed firmly to your chest and snap a bunch of photos. You'll need to fiddle with focus and exposure settings, of course, since you won't be able to see or feel what you're doing. Also, needless to say, you'll have to just guess on the framing of all the shots. You should probably use a digital camera, by the way, so that you don't waste a lot of film, because you're not going to have a lot of keepers. Of course, part of the fun of this challenge is changing the film with the gloves and helmet on, and you'll miss out on that by going digital. Anyway, after you fill up your memory card, head back home and download all your newly captured images. While looking through your collection of unimpressive photos, marvel at the incredible awesomeness of our Apollo astronauts, who not only risked life and limb to expand man's frontiers, but were also amazingly talented photographers. I'm more than a little surprised that none of them went on to lucrative careers as professional shutterbugs. Even if our fine astronauts could have captured all those images, the film would have never survived the journey in such pristine condition. Even very brief exposure to relatively low levels of radiation used in airport security terminals can damage photographic film. So how would the film have fared after prolonged continuous exposure to far higher levels of radiation? And what of the 540 degree Fahrenheit temperature fluctuations? That must have been some amazingly resilient film stock, and yet another example of the lost technology of the 1960s. Even though the images are clearly not what NASA claims they are, we're going to play along and pretend as though Neil and Buzz and all the rest of the guys could have actually taken them. The question is, where did they take them? Hoax theorists, debunkers, and NASA are all in agreement on at least one thing. Conditions on the surface of the moon are decidedly different than the conditions here on the surface of planet Earth. For one thing, the moon has no atmosphere. Also, there is only one source of light, which is, of course, the sun. NASA has verified that no other light source was available to the astronauts. Due to the lack of atmosphere on the moon, light is not scattered and travels only in a straight line from the sun and is reflected back in the same direction. What that means is that anything that falls in the shadows will be in virtually complete darkness. It also means that all shadows will be cast in the same direction. And it means that the sky is always black and, with no atmosphere filtering the view, that sky will be filled at all times with a dazzling display of stars unlike anything ever before seen by man. As other skeptics have noted, none of the other photos supposedly brought home from the moon show a single star in the sky. Debunkers have claimed that this is because the exposure settings on the cameras didn't allow for the stars to be captured on film. In order to properly expose for the objects being photographed, debunkers claim, shutter speeds had to be too fast and apertures too small to capture the stars, and that applies, according to the debunkers, to every single photo taken on the moon, even all the ones that, according to those same debunkers, were improperly exposed. NASA's own website has boldly stated that, quote, astronauts striding across the bright lunar soil in their sunlit spacesuits were literally dazzling. Setting a camera with the proper exposure for a glaring spacesuit would naturally render background stars too faint to see. The problem with this claim, which should be obvious to any photographer, is that a variety of different exposure settings would have been required to shoot all the photos allegedly taken on the moon. Winley acknowledged as much when he claimed that NASA pre-computed the necessary exposures. All of the scenes below, for example, which are obviously not very well lit, would have required long exposures. Exposures that would have definitely captured the brilliantly shining stars, since they would have been the brightest objects in the camera's field of view. These photos are great. One thing that I love about the debunking websites, by the way, is how frequently they contradict themselves while working their way through their debunking checklists. The ever-pompous Phil Play, proprietor of the appropriately named BadAstronomy.com website, is a prime example. Fairly early on in his debunking rant, he writes as follows, quote, I'll say this here and now, and return to it many times. The moon is not the Earth. Conditions there are weird, and our common sense is likely to fail us, unquote. Play does indeed return to it often, whenever it advances his argument to do so, but he just as frequently tosses his own cardinal rule aside when that is what serves his purposes. Like, for example, just four paragraphs later, when he advises readers to, quote, go outside here on Earth in the darkest night imaginable and take a picture with the exact same camera settings the astronauts used. You won't see any stars. It's that simple. Ever the coy one, Phil doesn't tell us what those, quote, camera settings are, but he clearly implies that those same settings were used in every photo, which is clearly not the case. Phil also conveniently forgets that the view from the moon is not filtered through an atmosphere, so the stars have many times the luminosity as here on Earth. Phil's little experiment, therefore, is entirely invalid, since he forgot to take into account that conditions on the moon are, quote, weird. And, as with all the debunkers, he also forgot to explain why it is that no one thought to expose a photo or two to specifically capture the brilliant display of stars. Legend holds that a dozen astronauts walked upon the surface of the moon for varying amounts of time. The Apollo 17 astronauts alone were purportedly there for 3 days. For the duration of their visits, each of the 12 would have been treated to what was by far the most dazzling display of stars ever seen by the human eye. What they would have seen was many times more stars burning many times brighter than can be seen anywhere here on planet Earth. Collectively, the Dirty Dozen took thousands of photos throughout their alleged journeys, and yet, amazingly enough, not one of them thought it might be a good idea to snap even a single photograph of such a wondrous sight. Of course, endless photos of the lunar modules and the monotonous lunar surface are exciting too, but just one or two photos of that dazzling lunar sky might have been nice as well. It's as if someone went to Niagara Falls, and the only photos they brought back were of the car they drove sitting in a nondescript parking lot. Now let's turn our attention to the subject of shadows. As skeptics have noted, some of NASA's photos seem to depict non-parallel shadows, indicating more than one light source. Debunkers have claimed that all such discrepancies can be explained by, quote, perspective and topographical variations on the surface of the moon. And truth be told, many of the images that I've seen on websites on both sides of the aisle are ambiguous enough that such explanations can be plausibly argued. But there are, as it turns out, images in NASA's collection that aren't quite so easy to debunk. There are, in fact, images that demonstrate unequivocally that more than one light source was used. Take, for example, the image below of one of the landing pods of the Apollo 11 lunar module allegedly parked on the surface of the moon. The primary light source, meant to simulate the sun, is obviously positioned to the right of the scene, as is clearly demonstrated by the shadows of all the objects in the background. But there's just as obviously a secondary light source coming from the direction of the photographer. We know this because we can see in the foreground that the shadows coming off the small moon rocks point away from us. We know it also because we can see the light being reflected off of the gold foil wrap onto the ground in front of the pod. But we also know it most of all because we can actually see the light reflected in the foil wrap on the leg of the pod. The shadows in the foreground and in the background are at nearly right angles, a phenomenon that cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, be explained away as a perceptual problem, especially when we can clearly see the reflection of the secondary light. The other question concerning this particular photo, how do you suppose you would go about capturing such a low-angle shot with a chest-mounted camera? Was the astronaut or photographer standing in a foxhole? The other issue involving shadows concerns the fact that, in the majority of the photos allegedly taken on the moon, objects lying in the shadows are clearly visible even though, due to the moon's lack of atmosphere, and the fact that the sunlight therefore does not scatter, those shadowed areas should be completely black. The moon, you see, is kind of a black and white world. If something is in the direct path of the unfiltered sunlight, it should be well lit, on one side. If it's not, it should be as black as NASA's starless lunar sky. The debunkers, of course, have an explanation for this. Let's turn once again to badastronomy.com for that explanation, since that seems to be the website that all the other debunking websites consistently reference and link to, the one that all the major media outlets endorse, and the one that even NASA apparently refers skeptics to. According to the site, quote, the lunar dust has a peculiar property. It tends to reflect light back in the direction from where it came. Play then goes on to provide the following explanation of the lighted shadows phenomenon. Quote, let's say the sun is off to the right in a picture. It's illuminating the right side of the lander, but the left is in shadow. However, the sunlight falling beyond the lander on the left is being reflected back toward the sun. That light hits the surface and reflects to the right and up, directly onto the shadowed part of the lander. In the previously cited sample, Play managed to make it through four entire paragraphs before contradicting himself. Here he has easily shattered that record by, incredibly enough, contradicting himself in back-to-back sentences. And this, keep in mind, seems to be the best debunker that NASA has to offer. Play is right on the money when he says that the light falling beyond the lunar module on the left would be reflected back towards the sun. Unfortunately, he then immediately contradicts himself by claiming that that same light would be reflected to the right onto the module. The only way that could happen, as Play surely knows, is if the light were to shine through the lander and reflect off the shaded portion of the soil. But that makes no sense, of course. Just as Phil's explanation makes no sense. Light does not disperse on the moon, as Play himself notes elsewhere on his website. And the surface of the moon, or at least what passes for the surface of the moon in NASA's photos, is not a very reflective surface, as can clearly be discerned in the photographs. Actually, it would be more accurate to say that the moon is a very selectively reflective surface, with the light choosing to reflect only on the astronauts and on flags and other patriotic symbols. Not too surprisingly, Play once again invites readers to reproduce the effect right here at home, completely ignoring the fact that, as he himself has acknowledged, light behaves in entirely different ways here on Earth than it does on the moon. Play also claims that, quote, a nifty demonstration of the shadow filling was done by Ian Goddard, and that can be found here, and there's a link to it on his website. His demos are great and really drive the point home, unquote. In truth, Goddard's, quote, nifty demonstrations are entirely dependent upon the effects of atmosphere causing light to disperse, and thus they have no validity whatsoever. I forgot to mention in the earlier discussion, by the way, that Play also appeals to readers to conduct an earthbound experiment to debunk the diverging shadows conundrum. According to Phil, quote, you can experience this for yourself. Go outside on a clear day when the sun is low in the sky and compare the direction of the shadows of near and far objects. You'll see that they appear to diverge. Here is a major claim of the hoax believers that you can disprove all by yourself. Here's another experiment that Play might want to try himself. Go outside during the daytime on any day of your choosing and look up at the sky. If it's absolutely jet black, then feel free to continue advising your readers to conduct moon simulations here at home. If it is blue, however, or gray or white or pretty much any other color than black, then stop pretending as though the conditions on the moon can be replicated here on Earth when we all know better, or we all should. And when you're done with that experiment, give the camera to the chess challenge a try and let everyone know how well that works for you. And try to get some of those low angle shots that NASA likes. The truth is that even though a limited amount of light would reflect into the shadows, there's still way too much detail visible in the shadows in virtually all of NASA's photos, if the arguments that NASA and Play put forth earlier are at all accurate. As readers will recall, the earlier claim was that the lunar surface and the astronauts' spacesuits were so dazzlingly bright in the unfiltered sunlight that very fast shutter speeds and very small apertures were required to avoid overexposing the shots. The problem for NASA and its attack dogs is that you can't have it both ways. If the camera is stopped down to avoid overexposing extremely bright highlights, it cannot simultaneously capture full detail in the shadows. And if the aperture and shutter speeds are set to capture detail in the shadows, the camera would necessarily also capture the brilliant stars, which would be far brighter than anything lying in the lunar shadows. Other planets would be pretty hard to miss in the lunar sky as well, though none can be seen in any of NASA's photos. Do you remember, by the way, what Winley told us earlier about the relationship between the aperture setting and the depth of field? The basic rule is that the smaller the aperture setting, the greater the depth of field will be. With a wide aperture, conversely, the photo will have little depth of field. That is why portrait photographers tend to shoot with the lens wide open, to deliberately isolate the subject from the foreground and background elements. Landscape photographers, on the other hand, stop the lens down to keep the entire scene in focus. With that bit of basic photographic knowledge in hand, it's fairly easy to determine whether NASA's photographs were, in fact, taken with a very small aperture setting. And a good place to start, I suppose, is with the very first photo taken allegedly by a man standing on lunar soil. Below is what is alleged to be Armstrong's very first attempt at lunar photography, just after climbing down from the module. Wow, clear shot. Very shallow depth of field. First off, I think we can all agree that under the circumstances, it's a pretty damn good first effort. There are problems right off the bat, of course, with the fact that the shadows are obviously lit with a diffused secondary light source, or else we wouldn't be able to see the top of the bag, or the United States signs, or the shadowed side of the landing strut. But what we're really looking for here is depth of field, which this photo has very little of. The photographer is focused on the United States sign, and he did it blindly, but little else is sharply focused, hence we know from the very first shot that the debunkers are lying about the exposure settings. Moving on to Armstrong's second alleged photo seen below, we again find that there is very little depth of field. And what he means, folks, is that there is some elements out of focus at the foreground and in the background. If it were a very wide depth of field, everything would be in focus, but it's not the case with this shot. And this is what he's trying to say, is that the camera was used in a fast way, which should be showing stars in those skies. Both the foreground and the background are quite blurry, indicating that it clearly was not taken with a small aperture setting, and yet there is nary a star to be seen. Before moving on, there's one more of Armstrong's photos that I feel obligated to present here. It is, after all, his masterpiece, as well as being probably the most iconic of all the Apollo photos. I'm talking, of course, about the so-called man on the moon shot of cohort Buzz Aldrin, seen below, which is probably not actually Aldrin. My guess is that the same two actors did all of the moonwalking in the videos and photos from the alleged missions. We must first, of course, compliment Neil on the awesome composition. It hardly looks staged at all. Once again, I'm just not seeing the depth of field that Winley promised us. It's also pretty hard not to notice that Buzz's spacesuit isn't pressurized. Furthermore, the surface of the, quote, moon is quite unevenly lit, indicating that the light source used was much closer than the sun. And then there is the noticeable lack of any shadowing on Buzz's spacesuit. He's casting a shadow, but there is no corresponding shadowing of his body. Even here on Earth, that is only possible with a secondary light source. There are some photos in NASA's collection that were taken without a secondary light source, so we do know what fake moon landing pictures should look like. The action shot below of a lunar rover, for example, was taken without the secondary light to fill in the shadows. The shadows still aren't quite as dark as they would be on the moon, but the difference between a fake moon shot taken with a fill light and a fake moon shot taken without a fill light couldn't be more obvious. NASA liked the man on the moon image so much, by the way, that they essentially restaged it for the Apollo 12 mission. As can be seen below, a secondary light was used for that shot as well. Without the fill light, there is simply no way that a portion of the astronaut's spacesuit would not be shadowed, as it is in the rover photo above. Moving on then to the next issue, we have the mystery of the disappearing crosshairs. The problem, according to skeptics, is that the crosshair reference marks, which are etched into the camera's lenses and therefore should always appear on top of any objects in the photos, sometimes disappear behind those objects. Play actually gets this one correct in explaining the phenomenon as a problem of overexposure and contrast. When some of the brighter objects in the photos are overexposed, the fine crosshairs tend to get washed out. That is, in fact, a reasonable explanation for the effect. By the way, I mentioned before that I was not a rocket scientist. I am, however, a photographer. The claim that the crosshairs should be visible presupposes that NASA added objects to the photos, creating composites. I seriously doubt, though, that that would have happened. The scenes appear to have been carefully staged before the photos were taken, so that there would have been no need for cutting and pasting. And if NASA had planned on adding additional elements to the photos, I doubt they would have complicated that process by using cameras with crosshairs. It would have been much easier to create the composites first, and then overlay the grid marks on top of them. However, the same can certainly not be said of the images that purport to show various parts of the ship flying through space, which is supposed to be a two-dimensional rendering of a three-dimensional scene of the command and service modules in lunar orbit. If it were an actual three-dimensional scene, the spaceship would be 69 miles above the lunar surface, which would, I would think, make it difficult for a portion of that lunar terrain to obscure part of the ship's S-band antennae assembly. The shot, as can be seen in the enlargement below, is clearly a composite, and not even a very good one. So it is entirely possible that some of the photos allegedly shot on the moon are composites as well. I obviously haven't studied every one of them. I'm just saying that the ones that I have seen that have disappearing crosshairs do not appear to be composites. The next problem with the NASA photos is that some of them seem to have identical backgrounds but different foregrounds. As Phil Play explains, quote, "In one photo, they show the lunar landing with a mountain in the background. They then show another picture of the same mountain, but no lander in the foreground at all. The astronauts could not have taken either picture before landing, of course. And after it lifts off, the lander leaves the bottom section behind. Therefore, there would have been something in the second image, no matter what. And the foreground could not be empty." Play begins his debunking by stating, rather hilariously, quote, "As always, repeat after me, the moon is not the Earth," unquote. Play goes on to claim that distances are very difficult to judge on the moon, and that the two photographs were actually taken from much different angles, and yet the background remains virtually unchanged because, despite appearances, it is a really, really long way away. Either that, or one of the astronauts was really David Copperfield. The two photographs appear below. I'll leave it to the readers to decide whether, as Play claims, the mountains are in fact many, many times further away from the lander than the lander is from the photographer. And I'll do so while noting that Phil provides neither the photographs nor a link to them, but instead asks readers to accept what he says on faith. I wonder why he would do that if he were so sure of his conclusions. I also wonder why in the final photo the lander appears to be parked much closer to the, quote, mountains than Play would have us believe. And once again, folks, the photos are all right there on the website, and that concludes part 4 of Wagging the Moon Doggy by David McGowan. Head over to centerforaninformedamerica.com. Scroll down to the Features tab, look for Moondoggy, click and feel free to join us down the road. We'll be picking up with Part 5 here in the next day or two. Be sure to visit the book tab and purchase a book or make a donation to support the work of the late Dave McGowan and his family. As always, thank you for joining me. Look forward to catching you next time. Take care. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today we'll be picking up in Part 5 of Wagging the Moondoggy by David McGowan, where he'll be kind of continuing with the photography theme. It's kind of Part 2 to the last section. And so you'll definitely want to head over to the website, centerforaninformedamerica.com, and take a look at the photographs that he provides as well. And so let's jump right in, Part 5, Wagging the Moondoggy by David McGowan. Stars are not the only thing missing in the moon photos. Also conspicuously absent is any indication that the lunar modules actually landed in the locations in which they were photographed. Specifically, there is no crater visible under any of the modules, despite the fact that NASA's own artist renderings clearly show the presence of a substantial crater. Also, not a speck of dust appears to have been displaced by the 10,000-pound reverse thrust engine that powered the alleged descent. NASA's artist renderings also depict a considerable quantity of smoke and flames shooting out from the bottom of the modules, though nothing of the sort is visible in the purported video footage of the first landing of a lunar module. And it's linked here if you want to watch that. Allegedly shot from inside the module as it set down on lunar soil. In addition, despite the ridiculously close proximity of the immensely powerful rocket engine, no noise from that engine can be heard on the video. As can be seen in the photo above, the area directly under what is supposed to be the nozzle of the descent stage engine is completely undisturbed. Not only is there no crater, there is no sign of scorching, and none of the small moon rocks and not a speck of the lunar soil has been displaced. And if you refer back to the earlier close-up of the module's landing pod, you'll see that not so much of a single grain of lunar soil settled onto the lunar modules while they were setting down. Your initial response to this may well be, well, duh, why shouldn't the surface of the moon be undisturbed? Glad you asked. The answer is that the lunar modules were not placed upon the moon by the hand of God. They had to actually land there. And, in order for them to land there in one piece, they had to make use of the powerful reverse thrust rockets. If they hadn't, they would have made landings roughly comparable to a piano falling off the balcony of a high-rise apartment building. But, you say, isn't the gravitational pull of the moon considerably less than that of the Earth? Well, of course it is, but that does not render objects weightless. A vehicle of a curb weight of 33,000 pounds here on Earth, what the lunar modules weighed, according to NASA, still weighs close to 3 tons on the moon, so it's not going to make a very soft landing without assistance. And the assistance options were necessarily limited. NASA could not have used parachutes, such as were used with the returning command modules, because parachutes don't really work without air. So that would have been a dead giveaway that the landings were faked. They also couldn't use a helicopter-type rotor, because those also don't work in an environment devoid of atmosphere. What they allegedly used then to provide the necessary brakes was a powerful reverse thrust rocket engine. That is why, in the artist renderings of the landings obviously couldn't be filmed because no one was supposed to be there yet. An enormous blast of flame and a hot gas is seen shooting out of the bottom of the module. This massive reverse force would have served to counteract the effects of the moon's gravitational pull, allowing the module to gently set down in the lunar dust, unharmed and intact. And needless to say, that is kind of important when the very same vehicle is your only ride home. The debunkers, by the way, like to pretend as if the hoax theorists made those artist renderings up themselves, as if to say, hey, look over here, I just made up this drawing of what I think the landings should look like, and NASA's landings look nothing like my drawing. The reality, though, is that NASA's own artists provided those images based on the way that NASA claimed the modules would perform. What the debunkers are telling you, in other words, is that NASA didn't really understand how their own technology was supposed to work. Given the manner in which the modules allegedly landed, the problem here is that, unless the landing surface was paved with, say, concrete, an inordinate amount of material should have been displaced by the force of the rocket blast as the module was setting down. Jumping down, how then did the modules get there? Could it be that the lunar surface was so compact that even the considerable force of the rocket could not dislodge it? That might be a credible explanation were it not for the fact that the astronauts themselves, who, with the moon's reduced gravitational pull, weighed in at about 30 pounds apiece, maybe 60 pounds each with the additional alleged weight of their packs, made readily identifiable footprints from the moment their feet hit the ground. It appeared, in fact, as though the lunar soil had roughly the same consistency as baby powder, and yet amazingly enough, not a single grain of this soil seems to have been displaced by the landing of the modules. The debunkers, naturally enough, have an explanation for this. According to them, it's all about throttle control. Sure, the rocket on the lander was capable of 10,000 pounds of thrust, but they had a throttle. They fired the rocket hard enough to deorbit and slow enough to land on the moon. But they didn't need to thrust that hard as they approached the lunar surface. They throttled down to about 3,000 pounds of thrust. Let's try again to inject a little sanity into this discussion, shall we? First of all, no one with an ounce of common sense is going to cut the engine and let their 3-ton spaceship simply drop to the lunar surface. Nor are they going to cruise on in while progressively easing up on the throttle, effortlessly setting the module down, like a car pulls into a parking spot, as if they had been landing lunar modules since the day they were born. Because the reality is that 6 astronauts who allegedly landed 6 lunar modules hadn't done it before, and they only had one chance to get it right, because that lunar module was their only ride home. And if they damaged it in any way, they weren't going home, ever. They weren't going to do anything except die within days in the most desolate place imaginable. And that is why it is perfectly obvious that, if they had really gone to the moon, they would not under any circumstances have landed the module either of the ways that the debunkers have suggested. Has anyone ever seen a helicopter land? That is essentially how you would land a lunar module as well. The basic technique is to line yourself up with your landing site while hovering a fairly short distance above the ground. With the module, I presume, you would hold your position by utilizing those clusters of horns. Then, when you're stabilized and lined up just where you want to be, you very slowly ease off the throttle so as to very gently set it down. And if you've never done it before, you're definitely going to want to take your time. And that is why there should quite obviously be blast craters under those lunar modules. That is why NASA itself indicated that there would be blast craters under the lunar modules. And that is also why it is fundamentally impossible for the modules to be as impeccably clean and dust-free as they are in all of NASA's photos. And no amount of spinning from the debunkers will ever explain that away. As previously mentioned, there was much about the Apollo project to stand in awe of. Every individual phase of the mission was, in and of itself, a breathtaking technological achievement. Just blasting men into Earth orbit is a daunting task. So much so, in the nearly half century that has passed since the first two nations did it, the US and the USSR, only one other, China, has managed to join that elite club. And China has only done it a few times. In the entire history of space exploration, just over 500 men and women have ever orbited the Earth. Achieving Earth orbit was just the beginning. Then there was the 234,000-mile journey through the unknown to get to the moon, on a single tank of gas, in an unshielded spaceship, Then there was the main ship giving birth to the lunar module, and that untested lunar module then flying down and making a perfect landing on the surface of the moon. Then there was that same untested lunar module blasting off from the surface of the moon without the assistance of any ground crew and ascending 69 miles to attain lunar orbit. Then there was the ever-reliable lunar module finding, catching, and docking with another ship while in lunar orbit, utilizing yet more untested technology. Then there was the command module shedding the lunar module and then commencing that 234,000-mile journey back home. But as remarkable as it was to get the astronauts safely to and from the moon, their survival while on the moon was equally remarkable. To say that the moon is an environment incompatible with the survival of humans would be a considerable understatement. Which brings us to our next topic of discussion, those amazing NASA moonwalking suits. Those suits were able to provide the astronauts with everything they needed to stay alive in the moon's harsh environment. Remember NASA's elaborate rendering of what a moon workstation protected from space radiation would look like? Neil and Buzz didn't need any of that fancy stuff because they were wearing the magic suits. And those extreme temperatures of plus 260 Fahrenheit to negative 280 Fahrenheit? Not a problem when you're wearing the magic suit. Not only could they provide the cooling needed to combat the searing temperatures in the sun, but they could also provide the heat to counteract those frigid shadows. As can be seen in NASA's photos, the egress side of the lunar modules, the side with the ladder and hatch, was usually in the shade, though almost always well lit. What that means is that, after traipsing around in the sun for a spell, the astronauts would have to step into the shadows to re-enter the spacecraft. And when they did so, those spacesuits were apparently smart enough to react instantly and switch over from turbocharged air conditioning to blast furnace heating in the blink of an eye. In addition to providing radiation protection that today's technology is unable to match, and a climate control system that is beyond anything available in the 21st century, the magic suits also provided astronauts with breathable air, which definitely came in handy. What the suits did, in essence, was provide the astronauts with their own little portable, climate-controlled, radiation-protected atmosphere. Of course, to actually do that, if we're pretending that it could be done at all, the suits would have had to have been pressurized. And it is perfectly obvious from all of the photos that the suits were not, in fact, pressurized. Because if they were, the astronauts would have looked like the Michelin Man bouncing around on the surface of the moon. The magic suits had to perform one other function as well. They had to serve as head-to-toe body armor, because the moon, according to NASA, had a serious problem with drive-by shootings from outer space. Seriously, I'm not making that up. I read it on NASA's own website. In the very same NASA post that discusses moon rocks being constantly bombarded with absurdly high levels of radiation, another curious admission can be found. Quote, meteoroids constantly bombard the moon. Our old friend from NASA, David McKay, explains that, quote, Apollo moon rocks are peppered with tiny craters from meteoroid impacts. Quote, NASA explains then that could only happen to rocks from a planet with little or no atmosphere, like the moon. Unquote. Meteoroids, NASA continues, are nearly microscopic specks of space dust that fly through space at speeds often exceeding 50,000 miles per hour, 10 times faster than a speeding bullet. They pack a considerable punch. The tiny space bullets can plow directly into moon rocks, forming miniature and unmistakable craters. According to NASA, every square inch of every exposed surface of every rock allegedly gathered from the surface of the moon shows this pattern. By extension, then, we know that every square inch of the lunar surface is peppered with meteoroid craters. It really is no safe place to hang out. There you are minding your own business, lining up your golf shot, and the next thing you know, a meteoroid is ripping through your spacesuit at 50,000 miles per hour. That has to sting a little bit. Actually, what it would do is kill you, almost instantaneously. Not the projectile itself, which probably wouldn't be lethal after passing through the spacesuit, but ripping or puncturing your magic suit while on the moon is certainly something that you would want to avoid. You know that old saw about nature abhors a vacuum? How that applies here is that any penetration of your suit would result in all the air being immediately sucked out, and then your blood would begin to boil, and that can be rather unpleasant. I guess the Apollo crews really dodged a bullet on that one. Not one of the astronauts was hit, nor any of the lunar modules, nor any of the lunar rovers, nor any of the equipment that was used. I have to say here, by the way, that those Apollo guys were studs of the highest magnitude. Did they know what they were signing up for? What did NASA's ad say? Astronauts wanted. No experience necessary. Duties will include taking a trip to the moon. Return trip cannot be guaranteed. Applicant must be able to withstand levels of radiation higher than anything that can be generated here on Earth. Applicant must also be able to work comfortably in heat in excess of 250 degrees Fahrenheit, as well as in cooler conditions approaching minus 300 degrees. A continuous supply of breathable air may or may not be provided by employer. Snacks and water will be necessarily limited to what fits an employee-provided lunchbox. Restroom facilities will not be available. The ability to dodge 50,000 miles per hour space bullets is not required, but would be helpful. This is a great money-making opportunity. paychecks will be picked up upon return to Earth. The Apollo guys didn't have to worry about any of that, of course, because they were wearing the magic suits. Apparently those suits were yet another example of NASA digging deep into the well of lost 1960s technology.